Our help is in the name of the Lord, who made heaven and earth. Okay, welcome back to the Ancient Christian Writer Series after a long hiatus. Appreciate your patience. I pulled myself back together, but I'm glad to be back for our last three conferences of Cassian's work. And we're picking up with a new conference this week, the 22nd conference, the second conference of Abba Theonis on nocturnal illusions, and we'll be picking up on page 757. We had a few pages left of the last conference, but it was just their closing remarks to each other, so I figured we'd pick up fresh this time around. And this would be sort of maybe a little bit of an unusual conference to listen to, because Theonis is talking to Cassian Germanus about certain bodily movements that take place, in particular in men, and how these arise and how they are tied to purity of heart, that what is taking place in the unconscious on such a deep level that arises within dreams, but also in men's bodily movements during the night, and how this suggests that there is still a deeper level of purification that needs to take place than we imagine. That often the lack of purity of heart goes so deep that even when we get to a point where we are free from the passion, seem to be free from temptations of the flesh, that they will still show themselves in certain forms, manifest themselves in certain ways. That there are darker parts of the human person. And it's sort of interesting, I think Cassian and the fathers are pointing here to the unconscious, that there are realms of the human person that are touched by our sin, and simply by our own efforts, we're not going to be able to uproot them. It's only by the grace of God that the deeper wounds within us can be healed. But we can recognize recognize them when they manifest themselves, and also see what can contribute to them, that there can be small ways where we are negligent or lazy in the spiritual life, where we eat too much, we aren't being attentive to our fasting, and the body will react to that in certain ways. And so these are the things that Theonis will be pointing to this evening. And so again, we're picking up on page 757 with the translator's introduction. The discussion between Abba Theonis and the two friends, Cassian and Germanus, resumed 7 days after the celebration of Pentecost. And it opens with Theonis's praise of the two young men for having been willing to wait so long after their first conference with him. The teacher of spiritual things, he observes, moreover, profits from his own service of instruction. He then repeats the question that had been asked at the previous end of the previous conference, namely, as to why fasting does not always seem to guarantee freedom from the nocturnal emission of seed. To this, there are three possible answers. Either a surfeit of food and drink has demanded this sort of release, or some kind of spiritual neglect has provoked it, or finally, the devil himself has brought this about in order to humiliate a person who is otherwise progressing in purity, thus making him hesitate to receive Holy Communion. In this last case, the devil often succeeds in frightening monks away from fasting because they feel that it bears no fruit when they have had an omission. But fasting, Theonis insists, is necessary for purity. The conquest of gluttony has as its consequence that of other vices as well, inasmuch as all the vices are linked together. And so a man will often at night have an emission without being aware of it. And there could be a tendency within us to simply chalk that up to, you know, some physiological aspect of the human person, but Cassian, or rather Theonis, says, no, there's more to it here on a spiritual level. There are things that can contribute to the frequency of this, that it might not disappear altogether in a person's life, but spiritually, if we're negligent in some way, it can increase the frequency of these events. Hereupon, Jamanus asks whether the fact of having experienced a nocturnal emission is sufficient reason to avoid receiving communion. The old man's answer is that if such an emission is the devil's doing and we bear no responsibility for it, then we should confidently approach the altar. But if we are responsible, on the other hand, then our reception of the sacrament would bring upon us the spiritual sickness and death that is spoken of in 1 Corinthians. With this, Theonis gives an example of a certain brother who experienced an emission whenever he was preparing to receive communion. The elders to whom he brought his case determined, after investigating the various possibilities, that this was the devil's work, and they advised him to communicate. Once having communicated, he was freed from the attacks, which only proved that the devil did not want him to receive the sacrament. In reading this, I think, you know, our first pass through it, it might seem a little bit of a stretch, but as we get it further into the text, I think it becomes more and more reasonable. You begin to understand how this could be so. It is possible for a person, Theonis continues, to control the number of emissions, and on being established in purity, to arrive at the state of the eunuch spoken of in Isaiah 56, or the state of the virgins who, in Revelation 14, are said to follow the Lamb wherever he goes. But no one must ever think that because of this purity, he is worthy to receive communion. Indeed, it would be impossible to attain to such a degree of holiness, both because the Eucharist is so majestic and so much a gift of divine condescension, and because, as had already been noted in 2012, no one can be utterly free of infrequent and lesser sins. So another big portion of this conference is on worthiness to receive Holy Communion. And again, something that's not often spoken of these days, about preparing ourselves well and having a sense of when we perhaps need to embrace a greater spirit of repentance and self-discipline before we would receive the Lord, not wanting to receive him unworthily. Germanus then asks how one who is sinful and hence not holy may be permitted to receive communion. Theonis' response is to distinguish between holy or righteous and being immaculate. This distinction had already been made in Evagrius, whereas Evagrius, however, attributes a possible sinlessness to human beings. The just do not commit adultery and are not subject to condemnation. The perfect have no concupiscence and are not subject to faults. Cassian does not. Other human beings may be holy, he declares, but Christ alone is immaculate. So no matter how great or how deep the level of our perfection might be in the spiritual life, we can never see ourselves as immaculate like Christ, and in that sense never completely worthy of such a great gift, that we would always want to approach the Holy Eucharist with the fundamental attitude of humility, that it is perfect love that we are receiving, and we can never approach that lightly. Here begins a fairly long Christological section that is reminiscent of 5:5 in many respects. Theonis discusses several New Testament passages that raise the issue of Christ's relationship to sin, 1 Peter 2:22 and Hebrews 4:15, Matthew 4, and particularly Romans 8. With regard to the last, the old man's position is that the term likeness applies to sinful and not to flesh. In fact, just as his flesh was never subject to sin, neither was his soul to ignorance. The Gospels demonstrate, moreover, that what seemed to be sinful flesh in Christ was offset by actions that clearly manifested his divinity. Whoever then declares that he is sinless commits blasphemy by making himself equal to Christ. After this excursus, on the unique sinlessness of Christ, Theonis returns to the topic of the sinfulness of the holy or righteous person. He lists seven ways of lapsing into sin that characterize such a person, namely, by anticipating something seriously sinful in one's thoughts, through ignorance, through forgetfulness, by a careless word, by momentary doubt, through vainglory, and finally, by reason of some demand of nature. As an example of a holy person who fell into sin without departing from righteousness, he mentions Peter. The righteous do not fall irrevocably, the old man says, thanks to divine grace. He then refers to Paul and to his apparent admission of frailty in Romans 7:19. At this, however, Germanus demurs and wonders whether the apostle, who seemed to have attained to the highest perfection, was speaking of himself or not rather of sinners in general. Theonis, realizing that his response will necessarily be lengthy, says he must defer it until the following day, and so the discussion ends. Although the present conference had started with the theme of the possibility of achieving a state which nocturnal emissions could be eliminated, it rather quickly moves from there to a discussion of the reception of Holy Communion, the sinlessness of Christ, and ultimately the sinfulness of the rest of humankind. The exchange on nocturnal emissions, while important in itself and of no small interest to monks, who could give only the most unsettling account to themselves of their biological mechanisms, in fact, serves to set the stage for the much longer exchange on sinfulness that follows. By confronting his readers with a bodily phenomenon that inevitably reminds them of the shadowy powers at work within them that cannot be completely controlled, Cassian prepares them to be confronted some pages later with that general state of outright sinfulness which marks all of humanity apart from Christ. Indeed, the 22nd conference as a whole is a prelude to this still longer discussion of the same topic of the sinfulness that will be pursued in the 23rd. So again, you know, this has been used often within the conferences. A particular example is given of a sin or something like it, but is used then as a prelude to a deeper discussion of the spiritual life. And here it's this bodily phenomenon that leads us then to a discussion of our own sinfulness, the sinlessness of Christ, but then also our preparation for receiving Holy Communion. Okay, pretty clear. I mean, I think straightforward so far. Any initial thoughts? Yes.
I like that it keeps us all connected. In other words, that what's going on up here or in our heart and it will be expressed.
That's right.
It's all one thing.
Right.
It's not, there's no dualism, there's no separation.
That's right. And it tells us that our whole self has to be involved in the spiritual life. And that's why fasting and prostrations and all the other bodily aspects are so important. It's not, we don't live our faith only in our mind,
right,
in this notional way, but our whole selves have to be involved in the struggle. And that can be the beauty of our liturgies too. You know, we have incense, the kneeling, you know, bowing that takes place, and all of these are important and become reflections of what's going on internally. Okay, so we'll pick up with the text on 763. After nearly 7 days, the celebration of Pentecost was over. Just as the night began, that is, after the evening synaxis, we entered the cell of the Holy Theonis, anxiously awaiting the promised discussion, and the alert old man, his face cheerful and kind, addressed us first with these words. I admired, he said, how your very ardent zeal was able to put off for 7 days the answer to the question that was asked, and how it was able to offer such a lengthy delay to its debtor, even when he did not ask for it. Hence, it is most just that since your graciousness has willingly conceded me such a long hiatus, I myself not delay in repaying my debt. For it is a pleasant aspect of this usury that it produces greater profits when it is repaid, and that it not only enriches the receiver, but also does not diminish the lender. The one who dispenses spiritual things, in fact, makes a double gain, because he profits greatly not only from his listener's progress, but even from his own discourse, arousing in himself no small desire for perfection while he instructs his listener. Hence, your ardor is my progress, and your anxiety is my compunction. For indeed my mind was dulled, and I could not find in my heart what you were searching for until your ardor and expectation roused me from a kind of sleep to the recollection of spiritual things. Therefore, let the question be brought up, if you wish, whose answer we chose to put off a short while ago because of insufficient time. A beautiful little beginning, I think, and one that many teachers of the faith would agree with, that often they feel that they benefit the most in speaking about the faith. And I think priest in the confessional would say the same thing too, you know, that you provide this opportunity for those to encounter the life giver within the sacrament, and but there is a grace that flows to the confessor as well, and you begin to see that it's not work, that you're being fed yourself in doing so. And I think we've, you know, encountered so many times, you know, going through this and reading it out loud and spending the time, how it really does do exactly for us, I think, what Theonas saw his preparing to answer their question did for him, that it can arouse within us a greater desire and make us think more fully about our relationship with God, how fully we are engaging in it. Okay, section 2. Unless I'm mistaken, your question had to do with why we are sometimes titillated by lighter stings of the flesh when we are enjoying some relaxation, while occasionally we are harassed by sharper impulses when we are abstaining strictly and our body is afflicted and worn out, with the result that, as your own avowal made clear, when we awake we discover that we have been wet by the emission of natural moisture. And so there can be this sense that, okay, have we weakened the flesh so much, or has fasting made us, in a sense, more vulnerable to the attacks of the devil or to temptations? And indeed, you know, that's an important question, because to fast without praying is a very dangerous thing too, because we are emptying ourselves. We're creating a hunger within ourselves, a desire. And so if we are not coupling that discipline of fasting with deep prayer, it can give rise then to greater temptations of a bodily kind, that we feel that hunger in a very deep bodily fashion. And so we could arouse within ourselves bodily yearnings. So it's very important to connect the two together. And the same thing for prayer, that prayer will be weak if there isn't fasting, because we will lack that bodily element, that hunger and desire behind which we see our hunger and desire for God. Our forebears have taught that there are three causes for this onslaught, which occurs at irregular and inopportune moments. It is either stored up due to a surfeit of food, or it flows forth due to a careless mind, or it is provoked by the snares of the mocking enemy. So, you know, it might seem to us a little strange, but they would have, you know, being so attuned to what was going on within, you know, you could see why it might be a cause of humiliation for a monk. You know, someone struggling so much for this purity of heart, then to experience a bodily movement that is so directly connected to what often is impure. And so, you know, they became very conscious of what might be the cause behind this. But again, this might not seem like anything to us, maybe even a little bit prudish. But in reality, you know, I think we'll see just the opposite. The first, then, is the vice of gluttony, that is, of overeating or gourmandizing, which causes this excess of the vile moisture to be expelled. When it pollutes our purity during a time of strict abstinence, it is filled out not because of present hunger, as you may think, but because of the excess of past satiety. For what had been amassed within a person through the gluttony of overeating will inevitably be evacuated by some irritation, even when the body is unaware and has been weakened by much fasting. Therefore, by an even-handed abstinence, we should not only keep from richer dishes, but also be temperate regarding more common foods. Indeed, we should even be aware of satiety of bread and water, so that the purity of body which we have acquired may long remain in us and imitate in some respect our inviolate chastity of spirit. So an interesting thing, you know, he's saying here that, you know, if we eat in an indiscreet fashion, it can give rise to this. So even if we are deep into fasting and have been practicing it for a while, if there was a period prior to this where we gave ourselves over to gluttony, then we at a later time can experience the effect of that, that we can never sort of cease something as inconsequential, that a gluttony at a previous time, even weeks ahead, or eating overly rich food in abundance can have an effect upon us down the line, because we broke that kind of discipline and the regularity of that discipline in our spiritual life. And again, I think this is one of the important things that come up from the Desert Fathers about engaging in our spiritual disciplines in a regular fashion and not episodically. That it's that regularity that helps to sustain the kind of peace and internal peace and purity of heart that we, and stillness that we would be seeking in the spiritual life. If we are up and down in our spiritual practices, we're not going to make much of a gain. And so they would, as we said before, would fast regularly, even daily, that 24-hour fast. And so if they had to break off of it for some reason of hospitality, it wouldn't be a great concern, because they would know they would be right back into the discipline. But we can, you know, we can experience the effects of our negligence, say, in prayer. We might be very disciplined for a couple weeks straight, and then we'll take a little vacation from the spiritual life and take a few days off. And we might think nothing of that, but it is a moment of negligence or of laziness that can have an impact upon us and make us vulnerable to a moment that we aren't aware of. You know, it can come upon us quickly. And it's maybe not because we were being negligent at that particular moment, but because we were negligent, you know, a week ago. And so, in terms of prayer, for example, we really want to establish a regularity in the routine that we have on a daily basis, that it would be deep and daily, and again, not episodic. I read something recently where the author was saying that there's a kind of delusion when we don't create that kind of prayer role for ourselves, and when we engage in prayer at our own pleasure, because we're engaging in it only in accord with our own will at that point, and not simply out of our commitment that leads us, out of our love for God, which leads us to commitment. Love, true love, is always going to lead us to want to commit ourselves deeply to the things that lead us more fully into that relationship. So the deeper our love for God becomes, the more we're going to want to be committed to regular prayer, regular fasting. And I think so often in our day, we are tied to that kind of delusion. Well, I'll do it when I have time, or, you know, when it fits my schedule, or when I feel like it, you know, at my own pleasure. And there can be a pretty major delusion involved in that that can lead us into great sin. Sure.
Well, just thinking about like the rise of not only temptation, but sort of just occurrences, when there's an increase in fasting, like you can see how effective that would be insofar as you just say, you know, forget it. Like, I was better off before when I wasn't doing mm-hmm. anything. But it also makes me think that we so often think of like the narrow way and the life of grace and the life of virtue as being hard and arduous because a life of grace and life of virtue is arduous. But it seems from this and from, you know, some experience too, that it becomes more arduous because of the rise in temptation, because of the rise of pushback that there is when you enter it. It has nothing to do with the relationship with Christ being hard or mm-hmm. narrow or rocky. It has to do with what Christ going out into the desert. It doesn't talk about all the 40 days of being hungry and fasting and praying. It skips over that and goes immediately to temptation, and that's where he's actually tested, which is kind of an odd mm-hmm. reversal of the way we think about it.
Right. Well, I think in general, you know, there is this tendency for us to live in such a sense that we can't pull ourselves away from what is immediately before us. And tonight we started reading, as one of our readings at dinner, the Screwtape Letters mm-hmm. with C.S. Lewis. And in the first letter, he begins to talk about, you know, just getting them to focus on what they feel is real life. You know, that getting them overly focused on that somehow being focused on the spiritual life and spiritual disciplines are something that you would want them to, you know, gradually be pulled away from, that they have to be attentive to the realities around them. And so that the spiritual life begins to seem not real or not valuable, that we aren't participating fully in life. And so we can be pulled back, sucked back in again and again. To be attentive to all these things going on around us, but not attentive to the things that are truly necessary for the life of virtue and intimacy with God. So we'll get overly focused on our work, or he describes it as, you know, the man is in his room reading and puts the thought in his mind, well, I'll feel better if I just get out, and I'll have clearer thinking if I pick up after lunch. And he says, as soon as I put the thought in his mind, he's already at the door and on his way out. And then as he's coming out the building, he catches sight of a bus going by and a newspaper boy. And then right there, you know, he's sucked into the real life. You know, this bus going by and the newspaper boy, you know, crying out, you know, selling his newspaper. And all of a sudden that becomes, you know, what's important. You know, just live your life. You know, don't be, you know, so overly attentive to these spiritual realities. And I think that could be our tendency too when reading things like this. Like, is this giving too much attention, you know, on all these deep levels to our pursuit of that intimacy with God, but also the purity of heart that is really the fundamental point of the conference. And I think we're often pulled away from this, of thinking, well, this is impossible. It's unreachable. You know, this level of prayer or fasting or attentiveness to our thoughts, you know, for goodness sake, just, you know, drink a beer already, or, you know, or, you know, watch a sitcom, you know, and don't be so overly concerned about the spiritual life.
When we do neglect mm-hmm. prayer, I think subconsciously we already are preparing in our minds what we will substitute in the place of that mm-hmm. prayer, but we push it back, of course, then have turmoil and guilt because we know right at that point when we're neglecting it that we're probably going to substitute with this. And then while you're substituting, the turmoil
yeah.
comes in. And there's never, it's almost like a form of gluttony at another.
Yeah, it doesn't take much, I think, to pull us away from it. A simple thought or an idea can be put before us that pulls us away from where we need to be, to move to something that's, you know, busies the mind or our life and pulls us away from that simplicity that can really listen to God on a deep level. And we that we can be engaged specifically in the act of, you know, some spiritual practice and have that happen, or be on retreat and have that happen. Did I tell you that story about being out at the Abbey of the Genesee in upstate New York? They had, 1 year they put me in this room on the second floor of the retreat house, and the windows were at the top of the ceiling. So as all you could see was sky looking out these windows, and I was sitting in my room, and I had been praying, and the thought came into my mind, you know, well, I should read that book. And I caught myself, you know, I got up and started walking over to pick up the book, and I knew it was to distract myself from the silence. You know, I wanted something to read, to pass that time, and to get out of that deep silence. And it was very subtle, just a simple thought. Oh, you should read. You know, you should read that book. You know, break out of that silence. Yes.
You know, it's in the Screwtape Letters. There's a passage later on. I think about it every time. I think putting off something is no big deal, where the uncle is telling, it's the uncle telling Screwtape, right? He's the young demon, that when you're trying to tempt a person to sin, you put into their mind that God loves them and that nothing they do is going to hurt him and bother him. It's all for you anyway, and that putting something off is no big deal. And then the moment they've put it off, you tell them that he's harsh and judgmental and you've committed the worst sin possible and you've been so neglectful, so that then they're so humiliated and like destroyed that they won't even like want to go to confession for it, because they and that's kind of exactly what it is, like that binge and then the horror at having, you know, it's the same thing. I always thought that was the most poignant passage, was kind of feeding mercy beforehand and damnation after. It's really interesting.
Well, that was a good hiatus, so why don't we move on to what Fiona teaches them. He says, yet it is necessary for us to recognize that there are occasionally some who, even without any effort of mind, because of either the equilibrium of their bodies or their mature age, are rarely soiled or indeed never polluted by the emission of this fluid. But it is one thing to attain to peace by passive good fortune, and another to be worthy of a triumph thanks to one's glorious virtues. The power of the latter, victorious over every vice, is worthy of admiration. Why, I would say that in the former case, where an ineluctable good offered protection despite one's own indolence, there is more that is worthy of pity than of praise. So, you know, just naturally, some might not have this tendency on a physiological level, but others really strive over the years to attain it. Philip Neri is actually a wonderful example of this, and if you read some of the early biographies, especially the ones that were put forward for his cause, you know, the ones who cleaned his sheets, it seems like a funny thing, but within the detail that they provide for his cause, that the one who cleans his sheets testifies that there never was evidence of this reality. in, you know, in his life, so that he had attained such chastity and purity of heart from his youth that by, you know, older age, you know, he had been freed from what was more of a common experience for most men. Okay, section four, or number four. The second cause of this unclean emission arises when the mind is empty of spiritual pursuits and practices and is not instructed in the discipline of the inner man. Then it leads astray the person who is draped in laziness, in keeping with his habitual and continual torpor, or else it lusts after bits of impure thoughts, so indolently unconcerned about the most sublime purity of heart, that it thinks that the whole of perfection and the height of purity consists exclusively in the asceticism of the outer man. Through the fault of his error and negligence, it consequently happens that not only do numerous roving thoughts break into the hidden places of the mind in bold and impudent fashion, but also the seeds of all one's former passions remain there. To whatever degree the body may be chastised by rigid fasting, as long as these lie concealed in the depths of the mind, they still disturb with their wanton fantasies the person who is sleeping. As a result of them, the vile moisture is expelled before its customary time by reason not of natural necessity, but of wicked deception. Even if this cannot be completely arrested, not so much by the flesh in its weakness as by the caution and strength of the mind, at least it can be reduced to a simple omission with the help of God's grace. Therefore, the first thing to be done is to restrain our wandering thoughts, lest the mind grow accustomed to these diversions, and while dreaming, be drawn to still more horrible temptations of lasciviousness. So it's interesting, you know, you find here in the Desert Fathers, you know, the first depth psychologist, you know, very mindful of the idea of the unconscious and dreams and the effects then that negligence in the spiritual life can have. If we are tempting ourselves, you know, teasing the mind, as it were, with certain thoughts, images, fantasies, that we can expect that even if we are rigorous in our asceticism and fasting, that these little forms of negligence are going to manifest themselves in our dreams. And that often is a sign of, you know, a lack of purity, that still deep within us, all the passions that we gave ourselves over to, in, say, in our youth, are still there. They have, because they haven't been uprooted through this deep attentiveness and watchfulness of mind and heart. And to me, that seems to be a very important point, that, you know, we don't want to be deluded into thinking that, okay, we've practiced the spiritual life for a while and perhaps we've achieved a certain level of freedom in this regard, then to let up on that discipline, because things can be so deeply rooted in these deep parts of us as human beings that they're eventually going to manifest themselves, and they don't take very much then to stir them up. Like for Freud, you know, the conscious mind was just the tip of the iceberg above the water. You know, the biggest part was beneath the water. And I think in the spiritual life, we have to be aware of that too. That, you know, all the years that perhaps we gave ourselves over freely to the passions and weren't discriminating, you know, exposed ourselves to the things of the world, that can remain within the unconscious, and it's going to reveal itself. And so that can be a pretty good indicator for us, you know, in the spiritual life of what we still need to be struggling with and being attentive to. Any thoughts? Yes.
I can say too that probably, and besides the positive, mm-hmm. Happy moments of a youth spent, there's also that the possibility too that aversion to sexual experience could cause the same kind of upset. In other words, the mind hasn't adjusted to its reality, right, its own reality, and has probably created just as invalid a fantasy,
right,
to be able to cope as one who has had happy experiences and good memories.
So. Yeah, this is where I like Cassian among the Desert Fathers, because there is a kind of balance in his thinking. You know, not to demonize aspects of the human person, not to turn, you know, sexuality into something that is evil.
In itself.
Right. Right. And so you're right in the sense that, you know, a person who maybe struggles with a kind of scrupulosity in that regard can create, you know, a kind of such a profound negative image of it that it haunts him as much as the reality of certain experiences that one would have given oneself over to in one's youth. And so, you know, scrupulosity can be a really, you know, challenging and painful kind of spiritual malady that people experience, and that can give them as much difficulty in throughout the course of their spiritual life as anything else. So we don't want to create, you know, a negative image of things. And in some sense, I'm glad that, even though it is sort of interesting to have to read it out loud, I'm sort of glad that Cassian does this, you know, that he talks so freely about these physical aspects of what it is to be a human being.
Yeah, I just remember, too, that Julian of Norwich also talks about the God, the Lord, actually being with us even in these lowest parts, and she's talking about defecation, but that, you know, she's bringing this whole bodily thing with it. You know.
John of the Cross does too, and he says that, you know, certain, you know, so the love of God grows and one enters into the more contemplative states, that the body can respond to that in a physical way. And so not to become disturbed by that reality, that there is such intimate tie between the internal life and our bodiliness, that there isn't that duality there, that positive experience of the intimacy with God can give rise then to certainly bodily phenomena. And so he wants to calm his readers who at this point have led, you know, have attained a great level of chastity and purity of heart, have reached levels of contemplative prayer, but then find this manifestation of these bodily elements that show up in the spiritual life and can be really disturbed by them. So, all right, let's get back to our text here. Are we at number 6? The third cause arises when, a well-ordered and careful practice of abstinence, we wish to acquire the perpetual purity of chastity by contrition of heart and body, but in his hatred and the deceitful enemy assaults us in the following way while we are carefully looking out for the welfare of our flesh and our spirit, striving to destroy the assurance of our conscience and to humiliate us by some kind of guilt, especially on those days when we want to be pleasing in the sight of God by reason of a greater wholesomeness. He pollutes us without any irritation of the flesh or consent of the mind, nor by the illusion of some fantasy, but by the simple omission of fluid, thus keeping us from holy communion. But in certain persons, beginners and those whose bodies have not yet been enfeebled by the lengthy chastisement of fasting, this illusion may be believed to come about at the devil's doing, so that when he sees that they are pursuing more intense fast, he may overthrow all their attempts by this ruse. Thus, feeling not only that they have made no progress in bodily purity by their stricter fasting, but that they have even fallen seriously behind, they are horrified by strict fasting, which is the teacher of incorruption and the mother of purity, as if it were an enemy. So, you know, when it's coming time to receive communion, then to, in a sense, humble them in a way, or rather humiliate them in a way that makes them question the value of their spiritual practices, but also question whether or not that they should be receiving Holy Communion. So pulling them away from the primary means of experiencing the grace of God. And so, you know, can just in a subtle way pull them off the spiritual track. Hence, we should realize that we must not be purified of a given vice merely because it preoccupies our thoughts with its own disturbances, but because it is not content to hold sway alone without the company of others. And once a group of more cruel vices has been admitted, they ravage the mind that is subject to them and hold it captive in manifold ways. Therefore, gluttony is not to be overcome only on account of itself, namely, lest it ruin us by a burdensome surfeit, nor merely lest it inflame us with the fire of carnal desire, but also lest it enslave us to wrath and rage and sadness and every other passion. For if food and drink are given us in too small a portion, or late, or in a careless way, when we are under the dominion of gourmandizing, the result is that we are also agitated by the urges of wrath. Again, we cannot enjoy delightful taste without the plague of avarice, thanks to whose abundant means luxury takes pleasure in large expenses. But avarice, vainglory, and pride, and the whole multitude of vices are joined together as one. Thus, each vice, even if it begins to flourish in us by itself, furnishes the possibility of growth to others. An excellent point, you know, telling us again that all the passions are connected together. So to give ourselves over indiscriminately to one is to make us more vulnerable to the others. So our gluttony can lead us to anger and to avarice and all sorts of other kinds of sins. All right. Any questions or comments? Yes.
Up to this point, I thought that we had established that Satan cannot put thoughts in your head. He can only work on what he knows.
Right.
Now it seems like he's putting thoughts.
Well, a thought before the mind, not necessarily in the mind. That, you know, what Satan can pick up on are the subtle forms of negligence and laziness that we have, these patterns that we have, and then take advantage of that. Or good patterns, like seeing a young guy embracing a more intense ascetical life. And so seeing that, seeking to derail it by, you know, putting certain thoughts before him, or if something like this happens, then humiliating him in such a way that he begins to question whether or not he should receive communion, or question whether or not he should be fasting altogether. So it's not in the sense of controlling the mind or putting the thought in there as it is putting a thought before the mind's eye. Yes?
I think in the Eighth Conference it's described as weaving his own thoughts so seamlessly,
right,
that we cannot recognize that they are not our own thoughts.
Right.
So it's not like...
Mm-hmm. Right. And that this is where Lewis's Screwtape Letters really shows it well, you know, that it's without noticing, you know, that thought can be mixed in with our own to the point where we're going in the opposite direction that we would want to go in.
I'm just confused because if a man is sleeping, then he really has no control. Like he, so if the devil is possibly doing this, there's no control. I mean, the man is not aware.
Well, what the devil is doing is in response to the omission. So the omission arises out, say, out of, you know, having either naturally or having eaten too much or something along those lines.
It's all connected.
Right. But it takes place prior to communion. And so the thought that's going to be put into the mind is, you know, one of shame and questioning, discouragement about the spiritual life, and then make him want to not receive, where that is really the one thing that he would need and want to do. Okay, where are we? Germanus here responds, "We believe that this subject has been raised by the design of God so that, thanks to the occasion provided by the present conference and moved by the very order of the discussion, we would dare to ask in confidence about things that we would never be able to learn, since embarrassment had checked our confidence in asking questions. If then, at the time when it behooves us to approach the sacred mysteries, we see that we have been polluted by an illusion in a dream, should we presume to receive the sacred and saving food, or should we avoid it?" Theonis responds, "We should indeed strive with all the effort that we are capable of to maintain the purity of chastity unstained, particularly at the moment when we wish to stand at the holy altar. And we should exercise the most cautious watchfulness, lest the integrity of flesh that we had preserved up to that time be snatched away, especially on the night that we are preparing ourselves for communion of the saving banquet. Yet if the most wicked enemy deceives the sentinels of our slumbering mind in order to remove the medicine of heavenly healing from us, and he does this in such a way that no guilty irritation occurs, and there is no contamination resulting from an assent to pleasure, and if he just provokes a natural omission compelled by necessity, which only occurs at the onslaught of the devil and without any feeling of wantonness, all for the sake of hindering our sanctity, then we can and should confidently approach the grace of the saving food. But if this accumulation is admitted through our sinfulness, then we should accuse our conscience and stand in fear of the apostolic words, 'Whoever eats the bread and drinks the cup of the Lord unworthily is guilty of the body and blood of the Lord.' Let a person examine himself and thus eat of that bread and drink of that cup. And whoever eats the bread and drinks the cup of the Lord unworthily, without discerning the body, eats and drinks judgment upon himself. That is, whoever does not distinguish this heavenly food from common and ordinary food does not realize that it is not such as is permitted to be received by any but a pure mind and body. Then he says, 'That is why many of you are weak and sick, and many have fallen asleep.' That is, he says that spiritual weakness and death are begotten principally from this kind of reception. For many who receive it unlawfully and abusively are weakened in faith and grow sick in mind by catching the diseases of the passions, and they fall asleep in the sleep of sinfulness, never rising from this mortal slumber through a concern for their salvation." This is a very important section, because we live in a time when discerning the body and blood of the Lord often isn't taking place, and also preparing oneself to receive the Lord worthily isn't taking place, that we often will minimize the significance of such things, especially purity, and receive in a casual fashion. And here's Cassian saying, no, you know, you want to have purity of mind and heart before entering into this most intimate communion with the Lord, or you eat and drink to your own condemnation. And, you know, I think it's almost a gross failure on the part of priests not to be available for confession, because it then discourages frequent confession that is needed to prepare oneself to receive the Lord worthily. That what it has created, I think, is this sense that, you know, everyone should receive at every single Mass, no matter what's the state of their soul is, and that it's almost more embarrassing now not to approach the altar than it is to deal with the reality of one's own sins and one's impurity. And this is why Philip Neri, you know, when he seeks to revitalize the city of Rome and lead people to frequent communion, which he saw was a good thing, he first focuses on the frequent confession. And only having those receive communion who asked for permission that they were ready for, and even at times making people delay receiving communion in order that they might hunger and thirst for it more and seek to prepare themselves for it more. And I don't think there's any sense of that anymore. I think there's still a kind of belief in the presence of Christ in the Eucharist, but not the sense that we need to take special care of how we're entering into this reality. It's a kind of herd mentality now, and certainly not one that's rooted in the wisdom of the fathers that says purity of heart is the most essential thing here. And that, you know, especially when we would be receiving Holy Communion, we would want to make sure that we are in a good state.
Father, it sounds like, it would have to be a mortal sin to make them not be able to receive. And one of the criteria for that is your consent to sin. And it seems like in this instance there's no consent unless the mortal sin is performed beforehand.
Right. And I understand that, and I understand why the Church makes the distinctions that it does. You know, to have this kind of clarity, you know, between mortal and venial. But I think so often it's approached and used in a legalistic fashion that it actually harms the spiritual life. Whereas when you read the Fathers like this, you begin to understand that what is most important is that relationship with Christ and entering into that, you know, with a pure heart and not looking for caveats as, you know, that would allow us to receive, that our greatest desire should be to receive worthily, that we would live from altar to altar, from communion to communion. And so when we receive communion, we seek to embrace the grace that offers as fully as possible. And as we are coming up on our next communion, that we would be preparing our hearts and examining our hearts as well as possible so that we would, that communion would bear the greatest fruit for us, and that we would also receive worthily. And, you know, even if it has become habitual, you know, there is still responsibility in there for the habitual nature of it. But there is also the impact that it has upon the mind and the heart and our capacity to enter into that intimacy with the Lord. And so if a person has been sitting in front of a computer looking at pornography for 8 hours and then masturbates, and that's the habit for them because that's gone on since they were 12 years old, you know, is it still, you might say, well, okay, freedom has been broken down there in a serious fashion because it has become so deeply habitual that one might even say an addiction, but what we would say, and the Fathers would say, passion, that has become a sin that's become habitual and deeply rooted within us, and the natural movement almost is towards that. And by simply, you know, thrusting a person into receiving Holy Communion, regardless of the spiritual state of their soul, I think doesn't bring them the healing. What we should be doing is what Philip Neri did, which was educating them in the ways to help uproot the passions and then help them enter into the healing sacrament of confession in order that they might know greater strength in that battle and then be able to gain the greater fruit of that communion with the Lord when they are able to receive. And now what we find is that, you know, there's so little sense of desiring this level of purity of heart and preparing oneself to this level that confession is neglected and everyone receives communion, no matter what state. I don't know of any priest that would be harsh with anyone coming to confession because of what they are struggling with. But I think where priests today are doing a disservice, I think, to those who are entrusted to their care is, you know, not emphasizing one of the fundamental things that they were ordained to do, which is to be present there to offer them the healing grace of that sacrament so that they can overcome and uproot the passion. I mean, I've been at a parish where a priest says, no matter, you know, if you're, no matter what state you're in, you know, everybody come forward, you know, offer a kind of loose general absolution. And he's loved, you know, he was loved. He's long since retired, but, you know, the church is packed and he'd do like this 20-minute Sunday mass and invite everybody to communion. And the standing room only. The whole church is filled and all the aisles and all the, out the back. But it is because it made it, the spiritual life, easy. But was that really, was he really serving them and bringing them healing or fulfilling his responsibility as a priest? And this goes for priests too. You know, the think of the extraordinary weight of celebrating Mass on a daily basis and what that should mean for the spiritual life of a priest. And this is the humbling thing. You know, I think when you look at your life as a priest and you think, how should I be living in order to be celebrating the Holy Eucharist every day? And, you know, the attentiveness there should be great. And yet there is such a profound distraction now from, I think, the fundamental pillars that Philip Neri saw as so important in the life of a priest: prayer, administration of the sacraments, familiar discourse on the Word of God, that we should be moving between these things, and this is the life of the priest and what he should be most attentive to. And often we can become as distracted as anybody else on things that seem important and valuable, but certainly not as valuable as the sacramental life or of prayer and adoration and things that would prepare us to enter into that reality. So I understand what you're saying, but I find, as a priest, I found that distinction between venial and mortal more of a hindrance in helping people in the spiritual life than something that's been helpful. That sometimes it's helpful in making distinctions for people, but more often than not, I find that, you know, there's this sense, well, you know, as long as I see it and understand it as something habitual or that I'm weak there, you know, that I don't have to be concerned about whether or not I receive Holy Communion.
Yeah, I certainly see that because, like, if I'm trying to prepare for Mass, it's like, oh, crap, was that mortal or venial? And it just makes more anxiety out of it.
Right. Whereas I think we should be more attentive to, you know, how have I been living my life? You know, have I been living it with this sense of one who's moving from communion to communion? And have I had this kind of watchfulness where I've been fostering that relationship with God in such a way that I can enter into that with peace of mind and heart? Or do I need to repent and engage in spiritual disciplines to better prepare myself? Yes?
Father, do you think it stems from within the Roman Catholic Church at the age of seven, first reconciliation, sacrament of penance, right? And then first Holy Communion, mm-hmm. and it almost carries through our lives, because what seven-year-old truly understands what he or she is doing at that point? And sometimes it's a callous attitude of the Catholic community of those sacred sacraments being taken so lightly at that age, and almost carries into adulthood that, you know, it's more of a celebration. It's not a communion with Christ that grows spiritually as you mature. It stays at that stagnant level.
Well, a big part of it is that the Catholic culture broke down. You had an extended family that would solidify that understanding that there's something unique about receiving the Holy Eucharist, that you want to prepare yourself. You know, the whole family would go to confession on, you know, Saturday nights before receiving, you know, or at least have the opportunity to do so. The Sabbath was kept in a fuller fashion now. And, you know, all that Catholic culture, as well as the formation that took place in the Catholic schools, you know, through the presence of the nuns teaching, you know, where this was consistently formed, you know, in the minds of children that, okay, we need to prepare ourselves for this. And even if that was poor on some level, it's still far more than I think exists today, which often is nothing. You know, Sunday has become the day for, you know, shopping and soccer games and things such as that.
If I may, I think I don't see it as much of a problem with age, as opposed to, like, I see confirmation as specifically as a big problem right now, because a lot of kids are sent to their confirmation classes without knowing what that actually means. And just with a lot of people I knew when I was going through it, it pushed people away, actually, more than helping them, because it's just my parents are sending me and I'm wasting an hour of my day.
So that age right there.
Yeah, I think it's just, like you said, Father, like, there's no support from the family that really makes it rooted within you that this is important. It's just, it becomes a certain amount of time out of your day that's been wasted, and that it kind of built more and more.
But I think what parents do, you know, certainly is going to set the tone. You know, the practices of parents are going to, you know, show the children what's most important. You know, what the parent values, the child is going to value. And so the parent is, you know, praying deeply and reading the scriptures and going to confession and loves the Eucharist, goes to adoration. Children are going to see that too.
From your mouth to God's ears.
Yeah. Well, we can only pray. Yes.
Well, I guess I'm wondering about something. I mean, we've had this come up a few times going through the conferences and everything, and I think there's a reason that reading and listening to this conference is going to be a little more awkward than other ones. You know, and there's a certain awkwardness to, like, the clarity of the sexual topic here. And it feels like that's pretty much the case always. Like, either sexuality is made this thing that everyone brazenly speaks about, it's made to be nothing or completely insignificant, or even people are just comfortable being kind of gross about it. Mm-hmm. Or on the other hand, it's a shameful, embarrassing mm-hmm. thing that, like Cassian, no one wants to talk about, no one wants to recognize, it's awkward. Like, we say, like, well, it's not that big of a deal, mm-hmm. but it's because, like, no one wants to discuss it. Mm-hmm. And it's particularly difficult to bring those kinds of struggles and sins to confession. Mm-hmm. So, and I feel like mostly, I think this is probably the only mm-hmm. area, situation, context in which I've ever experienced people soberly without either brazenness or like kind of harshness or timidity and shame speaking very plainly and clearly about stuff like this. Like, no one's super embarrassed to talk about sins of pride or sins of like so many other things. Like, why is it this that
what?
That no one ever speaks about the, like, even mm-hmm. Abba Theonis says, or even yeah, Germanus says, like, I'm really glad this opportunity came up, because
right.
even these guys who are pretty open and mm-hmm. speaking about things very plainly and asking questions don't want to.
They want to avoid it.
Or they want to avoid it.
Right.
Probably to yeah, a lot of negative consequences.
There could be a kind of shame or embarrassment about it. And I think because of the bodily element of it, you know, it can make people feel hesitant to talk about it. It's a very personal kind of reality. And so it would be hard to imagine getting up in the pulpit and, you know, preaching about this. You know, John Cassian says.
It seems kind of natural, though, mm-hmm. because at most you only share that with one person in your life, mm-hmm. right?
Well, I think that's where frequent confession would be helpful, because then that freedom develops then to be able to talk about, you know, one's thoughts, feelings, the experiences that one would have. And I think that's why somebody like Cassian and Germanus and others were so free in talking about this, because they got into the practice, too, of revealing their thoughts, whatever they were, to these elders, you know, on a daily basis. And when you're able to do that and free yourself from it, I mean, this is what psychoanalysis picks up, that, you know, the revelation of those thoughts and feelings, you know, suspending judgment and looking at them has a kind of value, just on a purely psychological level. And we seem to have lost that sense spiritually, even though, you know, our understanding of that value far, you know, precedes by 19 centuries, you know, the importance of it. That, you know, being able to freely talk about everything, lay it out on the table in order, you know, to humble yourself, to, you know, truthful living, you know, to leave nothing hidden is then how we are exalted and freed from it.
And the yeah. response of the one you're talking to,
mm-hmm.
the ultimate positive regard,
mm-hmm.
is what you're going to receive no matter what you bring. And
right.
that's a very special level of conversation.
Right. Privileged
yeah.
place of conversation, right?
It provides like an arena in which there's a normalization mm-hmm. without it becoming, you know, mm-hmm. there's nothing to talk about here. It's all just without it being what we see everywhere around us, mm-hmm. which is people making it not shameful, not embarrassing, not personal, mm-hmm. but now it's become completely disordered and mm-hmm. lost like all dignity and everything.
So, yes, one.
Okay. Just real quick, if we don't make any distinctions between venial mm. and mortal sins, and we want to be daily communicants, mm-hmm. and confession is not offered daily before mm-hmm. every Mass, mm-hmm. at what point can you confidently rely on the confidior, you know what I mean, to take away the mm-hmm. venial sins that you can't confess before receiving daily, and you right. want to receive daily for the strength and the grace that gives?
I think my purpose isn't to say that the distinction is unimportant. I think it is. I think there's a certain value to it. But there can be a kind of legalism that we get caught up in, you know, in just approaching the reality of sin in that fashion. We lose the relational aspect. And so, you know, receiving the Holy Eucharist is the ordinary means through which our sins are purged. You know, in God there is no sin. So to receive God, to receive the Holy Eucharist is, you know, to be cleansed, to be healed. And so it would be the ordinary fashion and the way that we would seek that forgiveness. But, you know, I think without that frequency of confession, it's hard to develop that a conscience that is well-formed. You know, a person would have to be very attentive to doing that in their spiritual life and seek a spiritual director. And again, it's one of those things. I don't think we can use that as an excuse. You know, say, okay, there's, you know, confessions are only offered in my parish a half an hour a week. Well, then go someplace else. You know, we can't, you know, nobody's going to take responsibility for our spiritual life anymore. We don't have nuns teaching in the schools, and we don't have, you know, multiple priests in parishes, you know, where there is going to be the strong sense of the value of that. So if we have to drive to get to a place where there, we have people come from all over Pittsburgh, you know, just because they know it's available. And so if that's what we have to do, that's what we have to do. Okay. So we're over time here, so why don't we, sorry about that. We'll stop there. I see everybody shivering too, so. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. The Lord be with you.
And with your spirit.
May Almighty God bless you, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit.
Amen.
Amen. Go in peace.
Thanks be to God.
So.